So thank you so much for your participation in the day so far. Welcome to our final panel session, which is called entitled Memoir on Mortality. So people engaging with ideas of immortality and reflecting and expressing that. So I feel it's a privilege to be chairing such three fantastic scholars, and I hope you'll find their papers speak to each other in the same way that you've been hearing throughout the day. So our first speaker is Wendy Jones, who is a MPhil PhD candidate at Birkbeck in London. She has a degree in English Literature from the University of Southampton, and she's recently completed her MA in Romantic Studies at Birkbeck. And Wendy is, her research focuses on the intersection of sociability, literature and radical politics in the album of Mrs. Birkbeck. So I'll hand over to Wendy.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A word first about my title, Silent to the Grave, a bit dramatic, but I wanted to just have a quick word about it. It's such a common expression, and it features in the OED. It has its own special section in the OED, and two definitions are given. The first one is of a place, and it describes it as either a hushed or containing no natural noise. But you can also use the expression in relation to a person being secretive and discreet. And in my piece, I want to talk about the expression in the sense of both a person and a place. The person is Anna Margaret Birkbeck. We've heard about lots of famous women and not so famous women. She may be unfamiliar to a lot of you. But I want to talk about her, and I also want to talk about her grave, which is the place, Silent as a Grave. So I'm currently doing research into an album created by Mrs. Birkbeck. And she was the daughter of a Liverpool merchant, and she was born in 1793. But she'd probably be of very little interest if she hadn't become the second wife of George Birkbeck. And here is George Birkbeck. I'm sorry I can't show you a picture of Mrs. Birkbeck. She doesn't seem to feature in any of the portraits of George. This is a picture of him in 1825, just after he'd founded Birkbeck College in London in 1823, that was then known as the Mechanics Institute. She doesn't appear in any portraits, but she does feature in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography in his entry. She's got a small piece at the bottom. She also features very briefly in biographies of George Birkbeck, and she appears here and there, fleetingly. She's in Godwin's diary as a plural, rather sadly. Either Birkbeck visits Godwin, or Godwin visits the Birkbecks. So she's dotted here and there. And what we glean from these various sources, limited as they are, is that she was much younger than her husband. She married him in 1817. And she was widowed quite early, having had six children, five of whom also died before her. So we know snippets of her life, but she's very overshadowed pretty much by this guy, hazy as he is in this painting by Samuel Lane, or taken after a painting by Samuel Lane. So she is very much this discrete person of the OED definition, from a 21st century perspective, certainly. The reason why I'm interested in Mrs. Birkbeck is she left behind a fascinating document. So I'm not actually doing any looking into her life, I'm looking into what she produced. And this is what she produced. This is Mrs. Birkbeck's album. This is taken from the lunar image of the actual album. Okay. It's a quite a large, very handsome book, leather-bound, loose-leaf pages, bound by a bookbinder. And inside there are handwritten or hand-drawn entries of various sorts from various people. There are poems, epigrams, personal tributes to the Birkbecks and to the album. It was a very popular thing in, well, from the 18th century really, but particularly in the 1820s and 30s, for women, genteel women and some men, to create albums and either write in it themselves or to get other people to contribute. And Mrs. Birkbeck is feeding into that trend. It also includes sketches and watercolours, as well as the odd printed items such as cards that are pasted in. So I wanted to give you a flavour of this album, because it's wonderful album. All these images are taken from the lunar image version, which is online and anyone can access. So this is the opening page, and you can see it's a beautiful picture of and a poem underneath of a child weaving a chaplet of flowers. which then features in the second line of the album. And the date here is September 1825, which is the month when Mrs. Birkbeck started her album. Excuse me. The facing page is another poem. You probably can't read it because it's quite faint, as you can see. But what the opening says is lines written for the frontispiece of an album intended to designate the sister arts. And in the poem, it implores the sympathetic sisters for some flowing verse on a virgin page. So there are a great many poems in the album. But there are also other things, as I said. This is a card that's pasted into the album. And it's taken from a piece, it's a drawing taken from a piece in the Museo Via Clementina in Rome. And it was probably given to Mrs. Birkbeck from someone who'd been on the Grand Tour, a present to her. It's initials at the bottom. At the moment, we can't trace whose initials those are. But the date is given as November 1827. And actually, the card has tiny little holes in it. So if you hold it up to the light would shine through. Now, it's then pasted into the album, so we can't see that effect. And then, as far as we're concerned now, it's even been digitised and rendered on a slide. So you have to use your imagination for that, for the light coming through the pictures of these birds. But the album isn't interesting just for what's in it. It's interesting because of the people that are in it. It was started in 1825, but it was carried on through to the early 1860s. And there's a vast number of very interesting people from the time known to the Birkbecks who feature in the album. So I want to take you through a few of their entries. George Birkbeck was part of a progressive social network. He was a pioneer in adult education, the working classes, or the working man, certainly. And a lot of the contributions in the album reflect his interest. So we see Robert Owen signing an epigram in The Socialist, and Henry Broome, the Whig politician. And here's a piece that I'm very, a part of an entry I'm very interested in, by John Falwell. He was a notorious radical, as you probably know, of the 1790s, and he's still going strong in 1827 when he contributes two poems and a picture to the album. Thelwall had known George Birkbeck from the 1800s. They had common goals in education. Thelwall lectured at the Mechanics Institute. But you can see on the plinth, I hope, on which the harp and laurel rest, Mrs. Birkbeck's name is inscribed. Okay, so I'm showing you a couple of entries by men. Mrs. Birkbeck's hovering there behind. Another entry to show the international connections that the Birkbecks had is from an ambassador of the Ottoman Empire, Laporte Sublime, to London, who seems to have very close ties with the Birkbeck's family ties as well. A lot of the same family seem to have signed the album. So it's quite easy to see that Mrs. Birkbeck completed her album by talking to George Birkbeck's influential friends, getting them to contribute to the album. But there are other individuals from other circles, and why it's less easy to see the connection with the Birkbecks. And you feel that it's got more to do with Mrs. Birkbeck and her interests. Because what I wanted to talk about was the literary circle that's represented in the album, which is very distinct in a way from the political contributors. So then we get a lot of people from the world of print and publishing, a lot of editors, a lot of publishers, but a lot of writers as well. Many women writers, poets, novelists, travel writers, children book writers, people like Emma Roberts, Isabella Spence, Agnes Strickland, Emma Louisa Emerson, but also more famous names, if you like. Probably the most exciting of all, I haven't got here, it's a piece by Mary Shelley, excuse me, which appears nowhere else in her published work. It's written by her, it's signed by her, it's called The Death of Love. And she contributed it in 1831. Another famous woman writer whose piece I do have is Letitia Landon. She contributed quite a few entries to the album. And there were entries contributed about Letitia Landon as well. And this particular one's a song in her signature style. And it starts about how vain to cast my love away on bosom false as thine. And she has several albums, entries in the album like this. So the album is kind of a patchwork reflecting the Birkbeck's several social circles and their tastes and their sensibilities. In addition to the album, Mrs. Birkbeck kept a scrapbook, which contains another large book, also digitised, which contains cards, mainly printed material, over pretty much the same sort of period. And there are other possessions of Mrs. Birkbeck's which she bequeathed before her death. Some of them are in the Pitt Rivers Museum just down the road, including a North American apron from the early 19th century adorned with shells, which she bequeathed before her death. But there's no diary, there's no letters, there's no portrait, there's no biography, and only one existing letter so far by Mrs. Birkbeck that I've been able to unearth. So this is Mrs. Birkbeck and her album. And from my point of view, she is as silent as the grave in very material ways, but her album is very eloquent, and the album, along with her other effects, constitutes my archive and what I'm working on. And this is why I need to bring in Mrs. Birkbeck's grave. And here it is, the Birkbeck Mausoleum in Kensal Green Garden Cemetery. She was buried with her deceased husband and her children in the family vault in Kensal Rise. It's quite an imposing vault, it's a listed building. And the physical grave actually provides me with some extra detail about her life. Firstly, it gives the actual date of her death, which is really nice because it's chiselled into the Portland stone as 1875. And that's helpful because other sources have her dying in or after 1851, which is reproduced in a lot of things you see about George Birkbeck, this date of her death, which is, you know, spurious. She actually died in 1875. Other things that the other information that the grave gives me is that she lost all but one of her children before she herself died. And on the grave it says that her youngest son died aged 32. Of intense grief for the loss of his devoted sister 3 weeks earlier. So the grave just helps me a little bit to flesh out Mrs. Birkbeck. But it's also got some secrets. And here's a snippet from a book of 1880, which is appropriately entitled Curiosities from the Search Room, a collection of serious and whimsical wills by Mrs. William Pitt Burns. I was worried about saying that, I have to say. Okay. So what Mrs. Pitt Burns says in her book of 1880, many persons have a singular mode of disposing of objects for which they have too great a regard to destroy them or even order them after their death to be destroyed, and as a sort of half measure desire that they may be buried with them. Mrs. Anna Margaret Birkbeck directs that the letters of her late daughters, of her late son and of her late husband, both before and after their marriage, be buried with her. Now, apart from that, the book gives me a little bit of information about her death date, so I'm pretty sure this is my Anna Margaret Birkbeck. But there's no helpful footnotes, there's no source for this, and I haven't actually managed yet to get my hands on Mrs. Birkbeck's will. So all I'm left with is sort of this tantalising result of a Google search, and the idea that's also tantalising is this. It's part of my archive, and it's going to hold information that I'm never going to get my hands on. So I'm very unlikely to establish why she took those letters to a grave. It's not, and I'm sure, an attempt to organise her literary work for posterity. She didn't see herself in that way, I don't think, but I'll never know. I don't think it's a half measure either, as suggested here. I suspect it was probably to do with the great personal value to her of the letters. Letters she'd probably been reading over and over again. They'd come to stand in for a deceased family over the years because many of her children died many years before she did. And the handwritten letters evoked the lost presence of this family, stood in for their absent bodies, if you like, but of prime value to her alone. So this woman who probably thought she was going to meet her family in heaven took something so personal with her to the grave. I think... But it's only speculation, and it's tempting to think of this discovery, and I'm going to use a pun here, for which I apologise, as a kind of dead end. You know, it's like, great, I thought I'd found something, I haven't. But I do think, after I'd got over the initial disappointment, that it is quite helpful in a way, in the light it shines back on the thing she did decide to leave behind her. This was a very decided act to take the letters to a grave. But it stands in stark contrast to the survival of the album. It's quite a big album. Go back to the album. Perhaps she didn't want to take it to a grave with her, but I suspect there might be more to it than that. When she died, she passed it on to a family, and it was kept by the family safely until 1955, when the album was passed on to Birkbeck College, presumably when the succeeding generations no longer felt an intimate connection with it. But even then, it was kept safely in the Birkbeck vaults in an enlightened library and had it conserved and digitised, I think about 10 years ago, when it started to literally fall apart. And I think this reflects and is indicative of the great value it has for us now in the 21st century. I certainly think it's got quite a lot of value. And clearly it's survived for the last 200 years because it's of personal value to Mr. Birkbeck, but it's a personal it's beyond that. It's a material object valued by people other than Mrs. Birkbeck. And this says a lot about the public aspect of the album, because it was a sociable object. It had something with value beyond the individual, beyond Mrs. Birkbeck. It was clearly of some value to the family. They're invested in it. George Birkbeck has a poem in it from his younger years, and her children invested in it also. Her eldest daughter was a friend of Richard Cobden, and in 1854 he signs his signature in the album. And it contains other family memorabilia. So the album must have had some resonance for the family as a whole, hence why they kept it safely until the mid-1950s. But the Birkbeck set had the wider social set had an investment in the album too. The album would probably, I mean, it's quite an imposing thing, would probably have occupied quite a key position in a drawing room on a nice table or something. And it would be available to display for people to read together, but also to add their contribution. So it provided a material social space for the people that the Birkbecks knew, not just the Birkbecks. I want to show you an entry by two of the women writers who appear in the album. Jane Porter and Amelia Opie. Again, it's really faint, so I apologise for that. The darker writing at the top is Jane Porter, who signs and dates, and beneath it is Amelia Opie. And I've just transcribed it here so you can just see that Jane Porter signs it, and then 3 years later, Amelia Opie adds her own tribute to Porter and her own signature. So they join a sort of circle of writers that have a community on the page. They're corresponding on the pages of this album of another woman entirely. The album even passed out of the hands of the family, was given to friends for them to get signatures in the album from friends they knew. And then there's even this entry by Gabriel Mantel, who is a geologist, discoverer of the Iguanodon, and the Birkbecks visited him in 1825. And at least a sheet from the album, or maybe the whole album, went with them because he signed it in Lewis. So this is a sort of sociable document in that it even made visits with the Birkbecks. The value of the the album is also, well, sorry. the destruction of the letters, the taking of the letters to the grave, also suggests the power of the handwritten. There are autographs, lots of autographs here. One here is from Agnes Strickland, famous novelist. She signed it in 1861. The letters suggest that handwriting stands in for people who aren't there. In the same way it works in the album, that Agnes Strickland, she's not just a name printed in a book, she's actually in Mrs. Birkbeck's album. And their entries in the album has great social importance for them and for Mrs. Birkbeck. She can gain a kind of social standing by demonstrating social connections with some of the most popular writers of the day. I mean, it's quite a good thing to be seen to know these people. And they get a sort of genteel publicity in return. But finally, the silence of the letters, the fate of the letters, brings me back to consider the silence of Mrs. Birkbeck herself. Is she really so secret and silent and discreet? We may not know much about her, but she did leave us this album. And this is one of the first front pages of the album. and it encapsulates the conundrum of Mrs. Birkbeck. The picture is an oak tree with flowers in it and a rope underneath, and it's a feminised version of the Birkbeck crest. And underneath it there's a roundel that's got her name stamped in it and the date. It encapsulates the conundrum of Mrs. Birkbeck because in an album that owes so much to the handwritten, she's only really detectable as a print. Somebody else has stamped her name in print on the page. Because we, for instance, we don't know whether she painted that oak tree because she hasn't signed it. And that is recurs throughout the album. She doesn't actually write her name in the album. I like to think some of the entries are hers, but I don't know for sure. So she can seem almost, you know, silent in her own book. But I have to think again about the entry of John Thelwall when her name was stamped on a plinth. And she does appear in other people's tributes. They have tributes to George Birkbeck, but there are tributes to her. And more than this, in a way, in every entry, Mrs. Birkbeck is present. She is controlling from the back. She is the one who is getting this album signed by people. Every entry is a sort of reflection of her tastes and her sociability, and she's traceable in that way. She is indirect in the album, but I do like to see the album as a form of indirect life writing, and to consider that, you know, people and places, graves and their occupants are not always as silent as they might seem. Thank you.
Wonderful, and I think I know that lots of you who work on objects and material culture will have loads of questions, so we'll just hold those for a second. I mean, if you were Rossetti, Wendy, that wouldn't, like, the fact that they're in the grave wouldn't stop you, so I wouldn't be disheartened.
I haven't thought about that. explanation.
So I'm going to introduce our next speaker, who's Sophie Conombo, who is a lecturer at Cardiff in English Literature. And whose talk is entitled Nata Mukta Obit, Hester Thrale Piozzi's Postmortem. And Sophie's research addresses literature and culture of the late 18th as well as the early 19th century. And her interests include identities, philosophy of language, literary and political self-fashionings, naming and anonymity in book history, material culture, fame and reputation, and particularly the Burney family. She has been a fellow at McGill and the Huntington Library and the Lewis Walpole Library, and she's also been in BBC AHRC New Generation Thinker. And her current work is on her first academic monograph is entitled Romantic Onomastics, Naming and Identity, 1770 to 1800.
Thank you. So my subject today is the life writing, though it could just as easily be called the death writing, of Hester Thrale Piozzi, who lived from 1741 until 1821. Regrettably, this fascinating figure is still most widely known as the friend, possibly the mistress, and certainly one of the first biographers of Dr. Samuel Johnson. Some still consider her apex of significance to be the 1770s and the 1780s, when she was a brilliant social hostess at her home in Streatham, providing a forum for Johnson and for other literary men and women to air their witticisms. And she is still sometimes described, even on her own memorial plaque, as Dr. Johnson's Mrs. Thrale. But in her own day, Hester Thrale Piozzi was famous and infamous in her own right, both during the Streatham years and for decades afterwards. Part of the reason for this was her colourful personal life. She was married first to the wealthy brewer and politician Henry Thrale, while also having that close, ambiguous relationship with Johnson. After Thrale's death in 1782, she scandalised polite society by neither remaining a respectable widow nor giving her hand as expected to Johnson, but by remarrying with her children's music master, Gabriel Piozzi, who was Italian, Catholic and impoverished. In her very old age, like her 80s, she shocked Bath gossips by conducting a close friendship with William Augustus Conway, a hunky young actor 50 years her junior, and by dancing at parties with what one onlooker described as astonishing elasticity. More importantly than any of this, though, she was a writer of extraordinary range and inventiveness. From 1785 until 1814, she published poetry, biographies, letters, travel writing, history books, political tracts, and works of synonymy. Her unpublished writings are even more fulsome. Voluminous quantities of her letters and journals survive in a number of libraries, and they include character sketches, tales, essays, fragments of drama, wordplay and puzzles, translations and epitaphs. It's to a tiny portion of this vast, rich and neglected archive that I want to turn today. Just one more general observation before I do so. My subject signed three different surnames throughout her life: Salisbury, Thrale and Piozzi, with the family name Lynch constantly hovering at the margins. And this all makes it quite difficult to know what to call her. For convenience's sake, I follow William McCarthy and Felicity Nussbaum in referring to her as Hester Thrale Piozzi, which is a permutation of her names that she never would have used herself, but it does acknowledge the span of her sociable and literary influence. But in a way, it's a shame that there is no way to refer to her conveniently while also preserving the ambiguity of her names in view. Because Hester Thrale Piozzi was intensely preoccupied, I would say obsessed, with the way in which the personal name functions to express identity and to communicate fame to posterity, or fail to do so. She was acutely aware, for example, of the way in which the custom of marital surname change worked, alongside other factors, to fragment the public identity of a married woman and to make it harder for her to, say, establish a literary reputation which could be easily communicated to future ages. This obsession with posterity, fame, and identity is at the heart of my paper and will account for some of the silences I identify in her archive. So what I'm going to do is examine Thrale Piozzi's marked tendency within her manuscripts to reflect on her own life by invoking the apparatus of death and commemoration, a kind of life writing that in my title I call the post-mortem, but I kind of call it now the auto-post-mortem because it's about herself. Specifically, I argue that silences and elisions are deliberately embedded at the hearts of these auto-postmortems, and that there is a good reason for this. 18th century public discourses of commemoration, like obituaries and epitaphs, were markedly affected by, firstly, ideological constraints on female behaviour, and secondly, by a heavily gendered idea of fame. And because of this, the complexity and the richness of female life was often reduced to a bald formulation that stressed simply birth, marriage, and death, with an aura of pious Christianity hanging over the whole. And just as an example, if you look at your handout, Stephen Howard has claimed, looking at obituaries in newspapers in the 18th century, the degree of wide agreement over which aspects of women's lives best merited commendation resulted in a corpus of biography and obituary that possessed relatively little individual identity. One piece was often indistinguishable from the next. And Howard further contends that familial relationships were the principal means by which women's lives were defined. Large numbers of women were simply presented in terms of their husbands, sometimes not themselves named at all, and many others were imbued with a coherence in their account through their portrayals as wives, mothers, and daughters, whatever other roles they might have filled besides. So I'm going to show that Thrale Piozzi experiments with the form of the auto postmortem in order to challenge and subvert such a formulation. By self-reflexively noting her own absence and insignificance, she could imply the inadequacy of public discourses of commemoration of women. She could also locate an authentic and a satirical voice in the exaggerated representation of her own silence. In the John Rylands Library in Manchester, there's an undated fragment in Thrale Piozzi's hand that appears to be the beginning of an autobiography. The manuscript's up here on my slide, and there's a transcript on the handout, which might be slightly easier to refer to. As you can see, the piece begins with two epigraphs. Please forgive my Latin and my French. The first is, Pallida mors aico, pede pulsat pauperum, tabernas regum quae turus, which I translated as, pale death knocks at the doors of all alike, be it the pauper's garret or the king's tower. That's a quote from Horace. The second is, le pauvre en la cabane ou la chambre le couvert est sujet à ses lois, et la garde qui vient au barnier du Louvre n'en défend pas nos rois. Slightly misquoted there. And that's from François de Malherbe. The poor in thatched houses are subject to its laws, and even the king's guards of the Louvre can't fight against it, it being death. So after these two epigraphs, the fragment continues in the voice of the author herself. She says, Nater nupta obit seems the natural epitaph for every female. Yet Addison holds it as a kind of satire, to register even in a churchyard, names of which nothing can be recorded but that they were born and died, or perhaps married. Their whole history being comprehended in those circumstances which are common to all humankind. Nor could I ever forget, since I first read it, the sly scorn with which he surveys tombs that contained dust marked by no character while filled with animation. Names made like those of Aeneas's companions to fill up the verse, or like those of Homer's heroes to be knocked on the head. It's a strange start to an autobiography. The introduction, including the epigraphs, invokes a well-established literary tradition of reflection on the inefficacy of fame in the face of mortality. She opens by quoting Horace, whose odes castigate the desire for glory and praise, and who contrasts the power of poetic talent to ensure fame with a futile reverence for genealogies. She then goes on to quote de Malherbe, which continues the theme that couplet subjects both the king and the peasant to the inevitable law of death beyond the distinctions that separate them in life. And when her own voice finally enters the text, it's to place her thoughts on gender posterity and remembrance in the context of Joseph Addison's essay, Reflections in Westminster Abbey. Even as she quotes these men of letters, however, Thrale Piozzi insists that posthumous fame is particularly difficult for women to obtain. She says the natural epitaph for every female is Nater Nupta Obit, which is the Latin in the first two words, in the case of the first two words, the feminine past participle for born, married, died. And in making this assertion, she feminizes Addison's original observation in his essay. Again, if you look at the handout, what he says is most of the epitaphs in Westminster Churchyard recorded nothing else of the buried person but that he was born upon one day and died on another, the whole history of his life being comprehended in those two circumstances that are common to all mankind. So in adapting Addison by feminizing her Latin and by adding the life event of marriage, I think she's demonstrating awareness of a tradition that defines women in death principally by means of the familial, especially the conjugal, roles they fulfilled while alive. But this assertion is complicated and qualified by ambivalence. The word seems in the first line is important. These three participles appear together to form the natural epitaph for every woman. But is this a fair summary of all that is achieved in a woman's life? And this ambivalence seems, I think, turns the attention of the reader back onto the deficiency of the form of the epitaph and away from the supposed deficiency of its subject. She modifies the three men's observations to describe the bare minimalism of the epitaph as a kind of satire on feminine life, not a true observation. And she furthermore indicates that the narrative given to women after death, being comprehended in those circumstances which are common to all humankind, is deficient, since it records and celebrates only a marriage, which the logic of the paragraph links to the passive subjection of being knocked on the head. The next paragraph of the fragment, I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but the next paragraph of the fragment draws attention to the transferability of the surname as a framework by which the ephemerality of a married woman's fame and the difficulty of encapsulating that fame may be understood. She weighs the value of a maiden name against that of the surname conferred by marriage, and thus offers an insight into the network of loyalties caused by the naming system under which married women must self-define. I'll just read out the first bit. My name was not made for me, certainly. Though rationally proud of it, I kept it but a short time, nor ever regretted the change. My father, she breaks off here, and when I heard someone the other day mention how few people there were who could tell the maiden names of their own four great-grandmothers upon a sudden inquiry, I thought how angry he would have been with me could I not have called over, and then she lists all her great-grandmothers. So, in this paragraph, Threlpiozzi laments the consignment to oblivion of female ancestry, before remarking her own unusual tenacity in determining to preserve and invoke their memories through means of recollecting their names, their maiden names, that is. The determination is complicated, however, by being set in the context of a father's displeasure, which invokes the patrilineal naming system. And the rest of the passage is also fraught with contradictions. She says she was rationally proud of her surname, Salisbury, yet she never regretted the change. She looks, perhaps with a slight touch of envy, on her ancestor Lucy Salisbury, who, because of her marriage to her cousin, was able to maintain a single name from cradle to grave while still obeying the dictates of propriety. In summary, this fragment exemplifies two features of Threlpiozzi's life writing. First, it displays an apparent fondness for assessing her own life by anticipating death. Second, it's a good example of the problems, the formal problems, the thematic problems that she appeared to encounter while do so. Written in French, Latin, and English, riddled with allusions to canonical male-authored texts and paternal injunctions while trying to begin her own narrative, vacillating over even the name by which she wishes to be known, and petering out after a couple of pages, the whole thing is on your handout. It suggests that the auto post-mortem was a form that presented as many problems as it solved. In the remaining time, I want to contextualise my close reading of that fragment by taking a much broader view of another piece of Threlpiozzi's life writing. In 1779, so at the height of her fame as the Streatham hostess, she was convinced that she was going to die during a difficult pregnancy. And she wrote a fascinating piece called Three Dialogues on the Death of Hester Lynch Thrale. These are a series of imagined conversations between her family and friends, real people, including Elizabeth Montagu, Samuel Johnson, Edmund Burke, and many others. And these conversations take place following her death. The dialogues are headed with a short preface in which, again, she begins by looking back to a canonical male writer. And in this case, it's Jonathan Swift. So she says, one of Dean Swift's happiest compositions is certainly the little poem on his own death. My death would be a slight event indeed compared with his. It would, I think, just bear three dialogues among the people I chiefly lived with. And some of them are insignificant enough too. Threlpiozzi's dialogues can be contextualised by comparison with the model she cites. Swift's verses on the death of Dr. Swift, of course, satirise my special friends who try to find their private ends in his death. You get Pope, Gay, Bolingbroke, all being criticised as somehow unfeeling or hypocritical. Like Swift, Threlpiozzi also features real people in her dialogues, but she also deviates from the Swiftian template by selecting the dramatic rather than the narrative poetic form. Because Swift is able to envisage the club assembled at the Rose, and he feels able to include in this company one quite indifferent in the cause, who my character impartial draws. The famous character sketch that follows, fair liberty was all his cry, etc., can be read as rather heroic for an impartial account. and the indifferent speaker might therefore be seen as a tool that enables the author to commemorate himself directly. Unlike Swift, Thoreau Piozzi chooses to use the dramatic form, declining to establish a single authoritative narrative voice that can praise her virtues. All we have are the words of her characters, and none of them are indifferent. And to show you what I mean in the final few minutes, I've included an extract from the first dialogue on the handout. It's quite a long piece, so this is just a chunk of the first one. And this extract involves the characters of Elizabeth Montagu, William Weller Pepys, and Samuel Johnson. I'm not going to read it out. I'm just going to draw attention to the ways in which these three characters treat the name and the memory of Mrs. Thrale as they stand about chatting at a blue stocking salon. There is, among the cast, a striking interplay between silence and volubility, with the character's willingness or otherwise to comment on Mrs. Thrale's death, providing an index of their sensitivity or lack thereof. Johnson is taciturn and restrained on the subject of her demise, in comparison to the volubility of Pepys, who harps on the topic with ghoulish, kind of exaggerated sorrow, and, for example, compares the galaxy of wits assembled at Mrs. Veazey's house to too many good dishes like poor Mrs. Thrale's dinners, drowning any semblance of serious mourning in criticism of what he sees as her feminine domestic excess. Like Pepys, Montagu appears to delight in using the death of her lost friend as a site for displaying her own learning and the use of absurdly overwrought similes. And you can see that the dialogue closes by contrasting Montagu's self-indulgent eulogy and Pepys's obsequiousness with Johnson's abrupt departure. Montagu exclaims, "Bless me, yes, she had remarkable good nerves and yet carried off so suddenly, pounced by death like a partridge upon the wing, caught in one of her flights, Mr. Pepys." Pepys is ecstatic at this simile and the stage directions add, "And now he runs about telling everybody what Mrs. Montagu said last, while Johnson, inquiring what the happy sally was and hearing it repeated, leaves the room, and the conversation is changed to a worthier subject." So use of Mrs. Thrale operates in this scene as a verbal indicator of a character's sensibility or lack thereof. Johnson's dignified mourning is characterised by silence. His strapline is, "I do not like to talk of Mrs. Thrale, sir," while Pepys and Montagu's promiscuous broadcasting of her name is figured as a means by which they fashion their own sociable image. Mrs. Thrale herself, friend and socialite, exists either in absence or in overwrought simile. The dialogues can therefore be read as supple, self-reflexive satires on how a married woman's reputation is mediated to posterity, with ultimate emphasis on the act of authorship as the only way that this can be achieved. Through an act of literary ventriloquism, Thoreau Piozzi is speculating on her own epitaphs, but she's also passing judgment into those into whose mouths she puts them. Comparing the two Mrs. Thrales mediated by the text, the one represented by the characters, and the other the hand wielding the pen representing those characters, reveals a telling disparity. The absence of a stable identity for poor Mrs. Thrale reflects a notion of the female self as unstable and shifting, different through the eyes of each observer. And yet, this lack of a stable centre is complicated by the deft and pointed satire on the behaviour of others that is the most notable feature of the dialogues, and implies a sharp, organising, authorial presence. It is possible to read the dialogues, then, as locating female identity within the writing process, within the impulse to satirise and to critique. In both of these pieces, it's possible to see ellipses performing for us, drawing attention to their own existence. Unlike the well-delineated public figure of Samuel Johnson or Jonathan Swift, the self that the pieces purport to represent, Hester Lynch Salisbury Thrale Piozzi, is never really there. In her place is a series of digressions, dismissals, and patriarchal relational constructs, which cumulatively build to a critique of the culture of non-commemoration to which Thrale Piozzi knew she would be subjected. It is the representing narratorial self, the writing self, that is firmly, unambiguously present. Thank you.
That was fantastic. I think one of the themes from today is about how several people have spoken about the women in relation to the men in their lives and how that might have sat with their self-representation and how they're kind of being redefined by new scholarship. And Sophie's paper, I thought, really spoke to that theme. I'm delighted to introduce our final panellist. And I love this title because, do you have it up? That really spoke to me when Gerard sent it is she wrote Fathers, Scratched Out Fathers and Not Mothers, memoir, and I just really like that. Joetta is an independent scholar whose PhD is entitled The Islanders, Mapping Paracosms in the Early Writing of Hartley Coleridge, Thomas Malkin, Thomas de Quincey and the Brontes. Joetta has published extensively both articles and book chapters on images of the child in children's writing, 19th century pirates and imagining Africa in the Bronte Juvenilia. She has been a teacher at George Washington University, University of Maryland and the University of London, and she's currently a student in information and library studies at Robert Gordon University.
Oh, it's a new title.
Oh, I know. You've talked about the title. I really liked my original title, too, and the first thing I was going to do anyway was apologize for changing it. Because the original title, when I scratched out Father and wrote Mothers, was due to my original compulsion when I discovered Charlotte Williams' notebook to acknowledge her presence and to credit the mother with her narrative contribution to the memoir of their child, Thomas Williams Malcolm. But on further reflection, well, second thoughts, I'm standing back and saying the published book memoir really is a father and mother's memoir of the child, rightfully so. However, we'll see about the notebook itself. And I'm going to go backwards into this notebook, so just leave it there for a minute. In 1806, Benjamin Heath Malcolm, a schoolmaster, antiquary, and travel writer from Hackney, published a father's memoirs of his child. The book is an account of the brief life and circumstances of the death at age 6 years, 9 months, of the eldest son of Benjamin and Charlotte Williams, Thomas Williams Malcolm. Born on 30 October 1795, Thomas was an extremely bright child, and alongside anecdotes relating his verbal precocity and moral aptitude, in the memoir, his father published examples of Thomas's writings and drawings, including a sketch of an imaginary kingdom, Allstone, which Thomas drew when he was only 5 years of age. And it's quite a remarkable sketch, for a five-year-old especially. It's better than I could ever draw, but anyway. So Thomas's precociousness and creativity were very much in keeping with an emerging romantic vision of childhood as a time of imagination, innocence, and inspiration, which would be promulgated by Williams, Blake, and Wordsworth, who had been influenced in turn by educational theories of John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, so a lot of men named William and John. And 6 months after Thomas's death, his father produced a brief account of the short life for the November issue of the monthly magazine's Eminent Persons column as an account of Thomas Williams Malcolm, a child of extraordinary attainments who lately died at Hackney. The piece, describes Thomas's acute intelligence and his artistic skills. 4 years later, then, Benjamin Malcolm published a much expanded memoir in book format. Benjamin was a schoolmaster, and a desire to participate in contemporary dialogues on pedagogy appears to be one obvious incentive for publishing this account of an amazing child, particularly as the book's dedication includes a description of William Blake's apprenticeship and introduction to his artistic and poetic work, Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience. Additionally, of course, there was, during the Georgian period, a positive craze for infant prodigies, witnessed on the stage and in juvenile publications. The trend which emerged in the 1770s with publications by Thomas Chatterton, Hannah More, and others, reached a peak between 1800 and 1810. And during this peak period, when Benjamin Malcolm published the article and the book about little Thomas, Per the count of literary historian Catherine Kitteridge, no fewer than 16 books just of poetry alone composed by children under the age of 16, and 8 of them containing verse by children younger than 12 were produced. However, 2 years after the publication of a father's memoir, the great-great-grandson of Benjamin Malcolm and Charlotte Williams donated Charlotte's notebooks to the British Library. 2 of the 3 manuscripts are travel journals. The 3rd is a notebook containing entries on her children, which I'm going to refer to as her children's book. The 1st entry in Charlotte Malcolm's notebook defines her intention to create a book in which I wish to preserve the memory of any particular circumstances that relate to my children, a little register of their early habits, in their own words, and to review their progress in virtue and knowledge with more certainty and satisfaction than I could do from memory alone. So she has a quite modest, this is the book, The Father's Memoir of His Child, and this is Charlotte Williams' notebook, which I don't expect you to read, with the 1st entry, January 1, 1801. At the date of this 1st entry, Thomas Malcolm would have been 5 years old. Reading Charlotte Williams' relation of Thomas's intelligence and good-natured character and his illness, it becomes apparent that the various anecdotes and account of Thomas's death and speculations on the cause printed in a father's memoir have been taken, in some instances nearly verbatim, from his mother's notebook. It is as disconcerting as discovering in Dorothy Wordsworth's journal that she was with William when the lone eye of his 1807 poem wandered lonely as a cloud through those hosts of dancing daffodils. Given the self-referential title of Benjamin Malcolm's book, it's also ironic that the account of Thomas in a father's memoir originated from his mother's collection of commonplaces. What does it mean, then, that Charlotte Williams' private narrative becomes part of the public production of her child, or that her writing is subsumed within a work attributed to the other parent? This paper attempts to explore these and some other questions around the suppression of authorship and the reproduction of family members' texts within those of other family members and to audiences beyond those intended by the author. First, though, it's useful to compare the two texts. I won't do much of this but in the interest of time, but and the two different contexts in which this child, Thomas Malcolm, is presented. Starting with this final production, The Father's Memoir. Like the frontispiece by William Blake, which incorporates an earlier engraved portrait of Thomas by Richard Morton Payne, as a book, A Father's Memoir is a strange compilation. It's an assembly of discontinuous parts. And you can see in Blake's portrait, he's surrounded this medallion engraving, and then the outside, which, if you've seen Blake's work, is very clearly by Blake, shows Charlotte Williams holding on to Thomas Malcolm as he's lifted away by angels. The book itself, as I said, it's a really strange assembly. The dedication is 48 pages and a long ramble to Thomas Jonas, a friend in Cowbridge, Wales, with whom Benjamin Malcolm stayed in 1803, 2 years after Thomas's death, when traveling and researching his book on the scenery, antiquities, and biography of South Wales. And it was Jonas whom Benjamin alleges persuaded him finally to publish this book about his son Benjamin, or his son Thomas. Benjamin knew William Blake, and the dedication also includes what is attributed as the first biographical account of Blake, a discussion of his work, 6 poems from the Songs of Innocence and Experience. None of these, obviously, are in Charlotte Williams' notebook. Following this discussion of Blake's apprenticeship and Malcolm's analysis of his poetry, it's in light of this concept of childhood innocence put forward in the songs that Benjamin Malcolm then discusses Thomas's character and describes in great detail the symptoms and the sudden illness that would prove fatal and the autopsy that followed Thomas's death. The book could therefore easily be assumed to be an attempt to place this child amongst those of the other celebrated infant prodigies, including 18th century child actors and Mozart. However, Benjamin Malcolm is very conscious and counter to what he perceives as the prevailing folly of the time, a passion for infantine and puerile exhibitions, inarticulate lispings, parrot-taught monotony, and premature and master-ridden study, to put it several ways, in which the child's memory has been laden with all the lumber of misplaced erudition. Benjamin Malcolm laboriously explains in the dedication that his purpose in publishing his memoir is counter to this. Remembrance is most sweet and sympathy most endearing to those whom mutual privations have brought together. Should this book beguile, but for an hour, the sorrows of a single parent brooding over similar loss, I shall not repent having put it together, though critics should disapprove or my bookseller shake his head. Yet there was with me a doubt of different nature, which took its rise from prevailing folly of the time, the passion for infantine and puerile exhibitions, so far from having been a motive for taking advantage of popular caprice, had almost weighed upon my mind to defer or abandon the project and set your wishes at defiance, Malcolm writes in the dedication to Jonas. Malcolm is a little bit wordy, as you will see. But surely here is something to delineate, he continues, which I can never have taught, the result of natural ability, not of labored acquisition, something with which art never could have manufactured nor neglect have utterly destroyed. On this view of my subject have I been emboldened to proceed, and I am not afraid lest the hero of my tale should be confounded with the common mass and vulgar rabble of prodigies. To substantiate his claim, Malcolm solicits a quote from Blake regarding Thomas's artistic abilities. Quote, all his efforts proved this little boy to have had the greatest of all blessings, a strong imagination, a clear idea, and a determinate vision of things in his own mind. However, despite all these protestations, contemporary receptions of the memoir were not necessarily favorable. Reading in the paper about Benjamin Malcolm's assuming the post of headmaster at the grammar school in Bury St. Edmunds in Suffolk in 1809, 3 years after the publication of this memoir, Dorothy Wordsworth, who had never met Malcolm, remarked in a letter to a friend in Bury that he must be a coxcomb based on the manner in which that account of his son is written. And it wasn't just Dorothy who objected. What was so disturbing then about the manner in which this account of the son is written? Dorothy's disdain raises additional questions about the reasons behind the publication of the memoir of Thomas, and in light of the fact that the anecdotes and actual account of Thomas's illness, death, and doctor's opinions, and the autopsy were taken from Charlotte Williams' own book. Charlotte Williams was the daughter of Thomas Williams of Lanblethian Glamorgan, a master of a grammar school and the curate of Cowbridge. Her children's notebook is a string-bound journal written in black ink. On the second page, she has a list of her children's birth dates, starting with Thomas Williams Malcolm, born in October 30th, 1795. And I won't have time to talk about it here, but the book lists all the birth dates of her five surviving sons, all but one whom she actually survived. So again, we've got another mother who survived most of her children, all but one of them. And if you flip it over, it reads from the back, and it's got the birth dates of all the children, including the babies that died after a few hours, the babies that died after a few days, and all the death dates of all the children that she survived. So it could be read as something else. It is sort of a tribute to infant mortality as well, but we don't have time for that today. We'll get back to that. There are three entries in the book, 23 pages totaling dedicated to Thomas. Sadly, following the first are two short anecdotal entries of February 3rd and April 20th, 1801. The longest entry by far is that of September 1802, relating the final illness and the death in August of that year. And for each of the other three younger sons whom she survived, Charlotte made single entries after each of the sons' deaths, summarizing their achievements and giving the cause of the death. She doesn't attempt to relate anecdotes about their growing up. She only does this for her eldest son, Thomas. As a daughter of a curate and schoolmaster, Charlotte Williams would have been well-educated, well-equipped to undertake the education of her children. Through what Mitzi Myers describes as the burgeoning print culture of the mid-18th century, women had entered the rearing and teaching of young children, and by the end of the 18th century, women, particularly mothers, had become represented as the primary source of taught morality within the gentry family. Charlotte, as her notebook demonstrates, would have been responsible for her children's early and moral education. The initial entry on Thomas, dated 1801, February 3rd, includes the following anecdote, illustrating how Thomas, at age 5, was capable of reasoning and his grasp of the English language. Thomas, having a knife in his hand at dinner, asked, "Pray, mother, what's the opposite to sharp?" Answer, "Blunt, my dear." "Then my knife is very blunt, for I cannot cut with it." Benjamin, this is Thomas's younger brother by 2 years, wishing to have some share in the conversation, but not well understanding it, asked, "What is the opposite to a door?" Mother, I know no opposite to adore. We generally express opposites by adjectives, not by nouns. Thomas, but there are opposites of nouns, you know. Nouns of behavior. Guilt is a noun, and it is the opposite of goodness. I felt right, Charlotte, but did not express any surprise to him at his so clearly comprehending what I had said in answer to the question Benjamin had asked, and his so readily adducing an example in proof of his assertion. Charlotte's clearly here in the text, her role as mother speaking, and in other places in the text, she's the clear eye in the first person. But I also find it interesting to note that she, in her response to Benjamin, the younger brother, she's talking to a three-year-old, and she deliberately evokes parts of speech referring to nouns and adjectives rather than simply giving an answer. And I can't quite imagine anyone today speaking like that to a three-year-old. But so when she was in charge of their education, it was education perhaps beyond what we now think of today as that of young children. So Charlotte's description of the incident illustrates not only her children's capacity for learning, but her role and her pedagogical approach in their formal and moral education in shaping their characters. In Benjamin Malcolm's book, in contrast, this anecdote, along with the two that follow in her notebook, where Thomas reasons things like, where can tomorrow be now? It must be somewhere. Everything is somewhere. Perhaps tomorrow's in the sun, and things like that, are related as, and this is from Benjamin Malcolm, specimens of Thomas's ingenuity and talent to illustrate by circumstances the turn of the boy's mind in conversation. Because description requires to be particularized by anecdote, writes Benjamin. In Thomas's father's account, he enhances Charlotte's response, and he also corrects Thomas's observation on the opposite of guilt being goodness rather than innocence. And Benjamin does this throughout the book. In the interest of time, I won't give detailed examples, but he does constantly edit and revise all of their words. 5 minutes? All right. So, importantly, where Charlotte Williams had simply recorded concealing from Thomas, Benjamin uses this occasion to elaborate on their pedagogical approach as parents, stating, "We are seldom, if ever, in the habit of testifying in his presence any surprise or admiration at the most opposite and ingenuous of his remarks. To have lighted up the embers of vanity by an ill-judged and extravagant applause would have been the excess of silly fondness." According to Felicity Nussbaum, commonplace books, journals recording everyday sayings and the like proliferated from the middle to the late 18th century. Nor is it uncommon for women to document children's development and transcripts of their lessons. Many 18th century British and American diarists, studied by Linda Pollock, at least partially educated their children themselves. Sarah Fricker, the wife of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, was, along with her sister Edith, who was married to the poet Robert Southey, responsible for the early education of the Coleridge and Southey children. Sarah kept a notebook in which she transcribed Hartley Coleridge's lessons in early poetry. Hester Thrale, likewise, just Thrale here, companion to Samuel Johnson, also kept a family book in which she recorded the educational progress of each of her children. And in this book, Thrale documented her children's illnesses and the treatment which she gave them. So this burgeoning print culture of the 18th century included many child-rearing texts directed at newly literate and largely bourgeoisie female audiences that for the first time named women as managers of their children and of domestic space, to quote Nussbaum. These often focused on health disorders, such as William Moss's An Essay on the Management and Nursing of Children in the Early Periods of Infancy in 1781, or Michael Underwood's 1797, A Treatise on the Disorder of Childhood and Management of Infants from the Birth, adapted to domestic use. Mostly written by doctors and almost exclusively by men, these books granted women ostensible authority and responsibility for the physical care of their children in assistance to physicians. So like Thrale's family book, Charlotte Williams' notebook becomes a place to record her children's sufferings in excruciating detail, as well as advice received in consultation with medical professionals. In the final notebook entry on Thomas, written in the month following his death, Charlotte Williams details the onset of a seemingly minor complaint on 1st of July through every step of the treatment he received in the very last moments of his death on the 31st. She records names, dates, and times that doctors were consulted. If we considered, well, we actually don't have time, but behind this is an accusation which provoked an autopsy of Thomas Malcolm conducted, which is related in Charlotte's notebook quite factually, and then repeated closely in Benjamin Malcolm's memoir. where they're actually accused of teaching the child to death, of over-educating him, and of his brain swelling. And Benjamin Malcolm writes, copying from Charlotte's notebook, "Were we to form our systems on the credibility of such suggestions, who would kill the darling of this heart with knowledge?" And then there's an autopsy following this, and it's with obvious relief that Charlotte and Benjamin record the outcome of the autopsy, Charlotte in her notebook, Benjamin in the memoir. "For this purpose, Mr. Klein, Dr. Lister, Dr. Pett, Mr. Toulmin, and Mr. Smith met on Tuesday the 3rd of August when Mr. Klein opened the head. It was to us an unspeakable relief to find it ascertained that there was not the most slender ground for the opinion advanced. The skull was capacious and full, and the brain unusually large. It appeared to be in the most healthy state and perfect in all its parts." This is almost a direct quote from Charlotte Williams' notebook. She's quite factual in her accounts, as opposed to Benjamin, who tends to be a bit wordy. So just to sort of skip ahead, I think in summary, what we get in the end is, and we don't know if Charlotte was like Dorothy Wordsworth, if she willingly gave her notebook to the main male figure in her life in order to support his publication. But in extracting an account of Thomas's life from her notebook containing descriptions of her other children, both the meaning and the purpose of the account become distorted. And as the I of Charlotte's notebook is subsumed into the we of Benjamin Malcolm's memoir, it distorts the entire purpose of the project. Women's role as educators of children problematize the idea of separate spheres, as Mary Hilton and Jill Sheffern have observed. Likewise, responsibility for health and welfare of her children, explicitly established in public ideology by the child-rearing text directed at mothers, creates an overlap between the role of mother and that of male medical professionals. The responsibility for moral education and bodily welfare is reflected and vital to understanding the excruciatingly detailed account of children's illnesses, particularly those that prove fatal. Restoring women to the larger historical picture is crucial to the study of educational practices of the gentry, and it's also crucial for understanding the various roles bound up in that of motherhood during the period. Outside of this cultural context, such accounts could easily seem luridly sensational, as Benjamin Malcolm's did to Dorothy Wordsworth. And without Charlotte's notebook and the wider cultural context within which such mother's writing was produced, it's really impossible to even begin to understand a father's memoir.